From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
About Viagra, America's most prescribed treatment for erectile dysfunction.
High anxiety, it's always the same. Anxiety, it's you. That I blame. It's very clear to me, I've got to give in. My anxiety, you win.
Today we look at anxiety and mental illness. We'll explore the globalization of the American psyche and find out why psychiatry is a profession in crisis. We'll also learn about the close relationship between anxiety and sound in Franz Kafka's work. But first, Patricia Pearson. She is a novelist and author of nonfiction. Her latest book is called A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine. Anxiety is now the most prevalent mental health problem around the world, according to a World Mental Health Survey. This same survey also revealed that the United States has the highest level of anxiety anywhere in the world. Patricia Pearson told Anne Strainchamps why she thinks Americans are so anxious.
I think the reason for that has to do with the higher degree of what you might call militant individualism in the United States compared to certain other cultures. So where you have that sort of high level of isolation, that sense that everything rises and falls on your own shoulders, that you have to have material aspirations, those kinds of things will provoke a much higher level of anxiety than even in countries where there are more fear-making experiences. So, for instance, in Mexico, where some of the drug guys are actually sewing their rivals' heads onto soccer balls and other frightening things going on around them, Mexicans have a much lower level of anxiety because they're buffered by certain factors. They're buffered by persistence of rituals that they engage in, by faith, by the constancy of their faith, by the uniformity and tightness of their community. So those kinds of factors will buffer what anxiety you would be having in those cultures.
Is one major buffer lower expectations?
I think so. I mean, that was something I pondered when I was down. I was born in Mexico, so I went down to sort of wonder about whether or not my own levels of anxiety would have been lower if I'd lived there instead of moving up north. When you have relatively low material expectations because you're basically in a situation of widespread poverty, there's less frustration or thwartedness with your station in life. It's tricky. It's a tricky thing to argue because you don't want to sound like you're poor and therefore happy, because that's not really the issue, but it's more that you have less, you're less self-remonstrative. You're less self-tormenting.
So what nations are amongst the least anxious in the world?
Well, oddly enough, China has one of the lowest levels of anxiety. Nigeria has a really low level of anxiety. So this was all done. The World Health Organization did a cross-cultural investigation into levels of anxiety. And they tried to train the investigators to make sure that they were getting the right answers, even though the vocabulary would be different in different countries.
Boy, you know, we think of both of those countries as having some of the worst living conditions in the world. Why would anxiety levels be less? You'd think they'd be higher.
Well, for instance, in China, there's a somewhat different formulation of selfhood. So you're living in a very collective society. Chinese children are brought up to be less self-monitoring of their emotions. Their parents aren't saying to them all the time, how are you feeling? And there's some interesting research on this, actually, comparing Chinese and American children. So they're not actually paying as much attention to their personal angst as opposed to perhaps their sort of collective concerns.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about your definition of anxiety as fear in search of a cause. Do you think that Americans simply have too much time to think? We're overthinking our entire lives, and this makes us more prone to anxiety?
I think it's not so much time to think as too many options. There's too many routes you can take. There are too many choices in the supermarket. There are too many jobs you can pursue or hope to pursue in this particular economic climate. There are too many lovers that you can have. There's an overwhelming amount of possibility, and within that freedom, you become very anxious because there's no sense of certainty.
You also write very movingly about your own personal experiences of anxiety. Let's talk some about your own history. What are some of your very earliest memories of experiencing extreme levels of anxiety?
Well, I remember being very anxious as a child, but I didn't recognize it as anxiety because I just had my own frame of reference and I thought everybody was just like me. But I had lived in New Delhi, India during the war that broke out briefly between India and Pakistan. And we were subjected to nightly blackouts because the Pakistani Air Force might bomb Delhi. And that began for me an intense fear of the darkness, a fear that I had to somehow be vigilant and try to control the night and keep my family safe. And then that displaced, because when I moved back to Canada, I actually forgot where the source of that anxiety had come from and just became fearful that there were serial killers outside my house. And I see this with my daughter now. She does the same thing. These levels of fear that embed in you in childhood shift and shapeshift as you get older and you can't remember anymore the origins. And then I think I was pretty much fine for many years. I had a very structured childhood and a very structured adolescence, and I think that helped a lot. I was in boarding school. We had to wear uniforms. There was a lot of ritual. We went to church every Sunday. So it really wasn't actually until I was in college that I had my first full-blown experience of really coming to a halt, where I was basically paralyzed with anxiety.
Can you describe some what happened then during that period in your 20s?
When I was deciding to write about this in my book, it was difficult because I wanted to be able to convey why it would be that having an early love affair collapse on you would be so shattering, given that we've sort of normalized the idea now that love doesn't last and that people have multiple partners and that it's all liberating and fine and to explore and so on. But I think that for me, because my parents had had such a stable relationship, that was a very strong sort of sense for me of my model of the world. And so when I was with someone who turned out to be somewhat sociopathic and unapologetic and unpredictable in sort of vanquishing me from their lives, it completely disturbed my model of the world.
Well, this is a guy, you were deeply in love with him. He behaved as though he was deeply in love with you, and then one day simply announced that he was also deeply in love with somebody else.
Yeah, without apology or... So it's not quite as simple as, you know, somebody just breaking up with you. It was actually the revelation that the person that you thought you were with was not the person that he was. But it's that sense of just having a shattered reality.
How did you recover?
I was at graduate school at the University of Chicago at the time. I withdrew, and I came back and had a very sort of simple existence in my sister's basement for a few months, watching the Olympics on television and learning how to drive. And I just came through it and restored my confidence without actually gaining any insight into what had happened. So it was many years before I understood what had made me vulnerable.
Now, you had a second kind of breakdown years later while you were working as a field producer for a TV show about true crime. Did that breakdown have anything to do with the subject you were immersed in?
Yeah. For several years in New York, I was a crime journalist, and I was completely fascinated by the psychology of criminals and what made a psychopath a psychopath. And I think that in retrospect, it was partly because of this earlier experience of having been with somebody who had sociopathic tendencies. So I needed to understand what made people the way they were in that sense. But I was quite careless of the impact on me. And so I would go to prisons, I would talk to murderers, I would cover very, very difficult trials. And I think there was a cumulative toxic effect. I think this happens actually also to quite often to police officers and certainly to juries, where I wouldn't call it post-traumatic stress disorder because I'm not convinced that that is a viable diagnosis. But it was more almost like a kind of cumulative intoxication of my psyche, so that I became quite suspicious of people around me and began to find it difficult to discern who was good and who was evil. Hmm. And again, that sort of brought me to a bit of a halt.
And again, did you cure yourself?
That time, I think I briefly, for about 2 weeks, went on something called Luvox. But then I discovered I was pregnant with my daughter. And so all of that period of sort of despair and dismay and apprehensiveness resolved into the creation of this new life and became very positive.
By now, we've created a kind of culture in which many people simply to get by need to take antidepressants. You've been there, done that, and decided that you didn't want to live the rest of your life on antidepressants, but found that it was actually quite hard to get off them.
It can be very difficult to get off them. I think many of your listeners will agree with me on that point. It depends on the one, but there's a couple that are particularly difficult to get off of. Really, I've known people who've had to go down to trying to withdraw one granule at a time from these capsules. And often it's just not worth it. I mean, it just becomes so complicated and time-consuming and emotionally difficult that people will put it off because they can still afford, you know, the monthly prescription. There's not quite enough of an incentive to do it, so you'll find that people are on them for 10 years, 15 years. What I decided that was bothersome to me was that I had lost some capacity for joy. And so not only had I lost my sorrow, but I'd also lost my joy, and I wanted it back.
It was a bargain you were not willing to make. The flattening effect wasn't something you wanted to live with.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that there are factors that can buffer us so that, you know, even though I'm wired to be an anxious person, there's ways in which I can keep that in check and that don't require medication. And so that's what I've been really trying to do.
What non-medical ways have you found that do work for diminishing anxiety?
Some of them are really obvious and practical, like exercise. I'm a bit lazy, but I know that it makes a difference, particularly for me swimming. So I don't know whether it's the sensuality of the water as well as the exercise, but that helps a great deal. Probably the most profound factor, I think, is in actually surrendering to the idea of a higher narrative, that if you can reconstruct the meaning of your life according to ideas of fate and of God and of faith, even though to me that's still somewhat alien because I'm from such a secular childhood and background, but I am beginning to recognize that understanding myself in terms of things being meant to happen the way they happen or not helps me. It helps me a lot.
Of course, we live in such a secular age, that kind of faith is perhaps harder for people to come by today than it used to be.
I think it is, and I actually think it's a shame. And when I listen to Richard Dawkins and Hitchens, I don't feel like they're doing us a favor. I really don't. There's so much research on the positive mental health effects of faith, on the positive physical health effects of faith. So to just attack it purely on the grounds that we have problems with doctrine and fundamentalist ideology is a shame in a way, because I think many of us could benefit from it.
Mm. You have a lovely and kind of intriguing passage near the end of the book when you write a bit about a church you go to. Actually, I was going to ask if you could read a bit from that section.
Sure. There is a church down the street from my house, a pretty little church with a diminutive congregation struggling to stay afloat in our culturally mixed downtown neighborhood. The priest wafts too much incense about and makes too many baffling references to the parable of Job and the fig tree. I come home and practice the language, announcing to my husband Ambrose, "And lo, I checked the phone messages that you hath not checked since Friday, and behold, you hath a message from the marketing director at A&P Groceries that you musteth return, for they are on deadline, and you hath not completed your cheese label task." I relish the idiocy. And I'm fully prepared to get used to it, for I have been idiotic all my life, an utter fool, believing that the man I loved and lived with would honor me, expecting my employers to cherish my work, hoping that highlighting violence would make it comprehensible rather than toxic, fearing cows and bills. How is any of that, any of our present secular experience in this time of profound social transition, less intrinsically foolish than praying ritually, as one does in the church or the temple or mosque, for the health of one's family and friends, for the community and the nation and the planet? I offer a modern update on Pascal's wager. In the late 17th century, the French scientist Blaise Pascal, lamenting that greater faith could be placed in reason if reason were only reasonable, encouraged his colleagues and friends to make a bet. "Wager," he said, "that there is a God, for what have you got to lose if there isn't?" My version is somewhat different. Dare to be irrational, because guess what? You already are. And wager that your life has a purpose, a meaning, an overarching story. And imagine within yourself a light or spark or Lord that will show you the way.
Patricia Pearson, reading an excerpt from her book, A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Do you have any personal experience with anxiety? How do you deal with it? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll investigate how American cultural influences are changing mental illnesses around the world. And a psychiatrist will tell us what's wrong with his profession as we continue our hour on anxiety and mental illness. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Ethan Waters is an author and frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Discover, and Wired. His latest book is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Waters argues that American versions of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders are spreading around the world like contagions. And he says we are the ones spreading them. He told Steve Paulson that America has a huge influence on how people categorize mental illnesses and how they treat them.
The symptoms certainly change from time to time and from culture to culture, and those symptoms have a great deal of momentum. So even for things like schizophrenia, which, you know, is generally agreed has some sort of biological basis, you find remarkably different outcomes across cultures. In fact, there's a famous World Health Organization study that shows that people with schizophrenia living in the third world do much better over time, including on things like remission rates, than people living in the first world. So there is, even with illnesses that clearly have a biological basis, how we think about them, how we look at the ill person, how we treat them definitely shapes the illness experience itself. The case I make in the book is that as America is so influential in changing how the world thinks about it and encouraging people to think like us, that we're actually homogenizing the illness experience around the world and indeed homogenizing the way people would then treat that illness as well.
Well, let's talk about schizophrenia because you have a case study of sorts. You went to Zanzibar off the coast of East Africa to examine this question of why schizophrenics in traditional cultures often have a better prognosis than those in America. What did you find in Zanzibar?
Well, I followed a researcher down there, an anthropologist named Julie Magruder, who was trying to figure out that question that the World Health Organization had put into the scientific literature. Why do people in developing nations often do better with the disease like schizophrenia? And Magruder very quickly focused on the story of spirit possession and how it was employed in that Zanzibar culture. Now, the narrative of spirit possession can be employed in some situations as an excuse for cruelty towards a mentally ill person. But in Zanzibar, it was much different. The story of spirit possession was employed to fundamentally keep that ill individual within the group, within the narrative of the group. It turns out in Zanzibar that the idea of spirit possession is not an extreme case. In fact, most people would describe their cognition as being permeable to the spirit world and permeable to the spirits of ancestors. So to describe the behavior of someone with schizophrenia as being along that spectrum actually kept them within the story of the group.
So they didn't become labeled as sick, as sort of, you know, mentally incapable of functioning in society. They were still part of society.
That's exactly right. And to the degree that they experienced periods of remission, that spirit possession narrative could also be employed to say, well, now those spirits are gone and he is back to himself. And it allowed sort of a cleaner bill of health during periods of remission.
So are there lessons here for the way we talk about schizophrenia in this country?
It's interesting because the end of that chapter, I tell the story of Julie Magruder, and she comes home from doing her dissertation in Zanzibar, and her husband has a psychotic break. And so she is suddenly in the position of trying to deal with a mentally ill person within her own family. And she indeed found it very difficult to take the lessons she learned in Zanzibar and sort of easily apply them in the American situation. Notions of spirit possession are hard to sort of apply, you know, on an as-needed basis. The kinship networks she had around her were much different than those in Zanzibar. There were so many differences that as much as she knew about how they did it in Zanzibar, there was very little she could employ. But I do think it should make us in the West think about that idea that the biomedical explanation for mental illness will certainly be the thing that relieves stigma. Indeed, there are many studies that suggest that as people adopt the biomedical notion of mental illness, they also simultaneously begin to see the ill person as more dangerous, that mentally ill person is more dangerous, as more unpredictable, more violent, and more permanently broken. So there's something about the biomedical explanation for mental illness that actually in certain cases, and indeed on average, I think, increases the stigma surrounding mental illness as opposed to decreasing it.
Mm. It's almost as if we accept the biomedical explanation, then we are hardwired to be violent or to be schizophrenic or what have you, because that's in our genes. That's the way our brains are wired.
That's exactly right. And that's what they find when they dig down on why the stigma increases. You find that those exact beliefs, it's more intractably, your brain is more intractably broken if it's a biomedical genetic issue as opposed to a life experience, for instance, or even as opposed to a spirit possession notion. So here we are in this conundrum. I believe the advances in understanding of mental illness through our biochemistry and our genetics is tremendously valuable science and should be pursued. But at the same time, it's a social narrative that has consequences beyond, that have consequences that are much different than we would predict. We would assume they would decrease stigma. And indeed, what we find is even in, as they're adopted in America, they increase the stigma surrounding mental illness. So we're in a little bit of a conundrum.
You also found that depression is culturally determined in some ways. And you have a particularly interesting story of how an American drug company tried to deal with this in Japan. Can you tell that story?
Absolutely. So I tell the story of how GlaxoSmithKline went to Japan with its drug Paxil in the year 2000. And it's pretty fascinating because Japan had avoided, you know, having any of the antidepressants on the market. This is long after Prozac was the best-selling drug in the world. Antidepressants had not been introduced in Japan. And the reason is because the Japanese had this very particular notion of depression. They had this idea that depression was an extremely rare and severe mental illness. It's translated as endogenous depression. It just didn't happen that often. And when it happened to you, it was as serious as a schizophrenic break. You know, you were in the mental hospital. Very rare disorder. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have other notions of sadness and melancholy, but they simply put all those other notions of sadness and melancholy in other cultural boxes, non-pathological cultural boxes. Indeed, many anthropologists have made the case that Japan is a culture that's sort of unique in the fact that it embraces sadness as almost as an enlightened state. The heroes in Japanese stories are often the ones that are just the most deeply melancholy, and it comes from their religious beliefs. And it comes from a number of sort of cultural stories that they tell about the self. So along comes GlaxoSmithKline wanting to sell Paxil in the way it sold it in the United States. And they had the task of fundamentally redefining what experiences of sadness were pathological and what were normal.
It's almost as if their task was to convince many Japanese that they had a problem that they didn't realize they had.
And that's just what they went about to do. And I found it fascinating that they actually went to many of the preeminent cross-cultural psychiatrists, these people that study and value the differences between cultures in terms of mental illness and the way the self is understood. And they went to those people to get their knowledge about how culture shapes the experience of mental illness. And they employed those ideas to understand, to change the Japanese understanding of where that line was between the normal and the pathological. And they created the phrase that they really spent a lot of money promoting was that depression was like a cold of the soul. A cold of the soul meaning it's something that happens to a lot of people. It's something that you shouldn't be embarrassed about taking medication for. You know, it's very common and you should just go to your doctor and get a prescription when you feel sad for longer than 2 or 4 weeks.
So did this work, this marketing campaign, that depression was a cold for the soul?
I tell you, they really hit it out of the park. Every psychiatrist, prominent psychiatrist I talked to in Japan has been just expressed their amazement at how at the expansion of this particular drug market and the expansion of this disease category. It went from being very rare in the 90s to being a very common diagnosis now. In fact, one of the prominent psychiatrists who was actually co-opted by the GlaxoSmithKline at the beginning is now trying to push back, and he's hoping he could change that phrase, the cold of the soul. He's thinking that maybe we should say it's the cancer of the soul, and he's hoping to sort of rechange the narrative again. And, you know, unfortunately, this lone psychiatrist, you know, does not have the, you know, resources of GlaxoSmithKline to sort of put that slogan into motion.
Now, you can interpret this story in two ways. You could say, oh my God, this is horrible. The Japanese have been duped, basically, into taking this drug when they didn't really have such a big problem. Or you could say that maybe some of the insights of American psychiatry were able to overcome certain cultural barriers, and a lot of Japanese people are now getting help when they couldn't get help before.
I think you could make both those cases legitimately. And the story I tell in the book is not necessarily one that the classic story of, oh, here's America messing everything up again. And indeed, the suicide rates that were on the rise in the 90s in Japan during their time of, you know, economic crisis appear to have stabilized and even dropped. So the drug companies can point to that statistic and say, that's the introduction of the SSRIs, and that's helping this population. So the evidence is not entirely one way or another. The case I suppose I make in the book is that it's not as simple just as sharing our science or sharing our medicine. As we do this, we're actually sharing our sense of the self, sharing our understanding about how the human mind works and how it relates to certain emotional experiences, and that those changes, as we impose them on other cultures, have an array of effects, and they go very deeply into the sense of self of another culture, and the consequences are sort of are far-reaching and not just simple. I do believe that as we create the good science, we should share it with the world, but I also think we should understand the value of the narratives and ideas and treatments that other cultures have in place before we simply homogenize them.
Ethan Waters is the author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Daniel Carlett is a psychiatrist. He's on the faculty of Tufts Medical School. Carlett is also the author of Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. He told Steve Paulson what he thinks the crisis in psychiatry is.
We have really become seduced with the notion that there is a medication fix to most problems in psychiatry. And along with that, we have spent too much time in our medical school training learning about a biomedical model of depression and anxiety, and spending so much time doing that that we've neglected some of the psychotherapeutic approaches. One thing that I've really noticed is that we tend to use the DSM guidebook, our list of diagnostic disorders, as kind of a shortcut for understanding people, whereas people are much more complex than is readily notable through a checklist approach. And that I think, is one of the main things that we are losing, if we haven't already lost that in psychiatry.
So you're saying there are a lot of psychiatrists, maybe most psychiatrists, who spend most of their time trying to figure out which medications to give their patients rather than actually sitting down and talking things out, doing psychotherapy.
This is really the baseline type of visit that most people will have if they see a psychiatrist. It's generally a fairly short visit, and it is one that's based on trying to find a label and then matching up the label with a certain medication. Although there are certainly still plenty of psychiatrists out there that enjoy doing psychotherapy and enjoy adding that to their practice. The latest figures show that the percentage of all visits to psychiatrists that involve some form of therapy are less than 30%, and that has gone steadily down over the last several years.
So why has that happened?
Because we become enamored with drugs, and part of that is due to pharmaceutical industry manipulation of our practices, some of the advertising ploys, both direct-to-consumer advertising and other kinds of advertising. And part of it, too, is just patients are wanting a quick fix. It's certainly much, much easier to wake up in the morning and take a pill if you think it's going to help you, rather than going to see a doctor once a week, paying a copay, and going through the process of telling your story. And that can be painful, it can be arduous, and it's something that not everybody is prepared to do.
Isn't there also just a lot more money to be made by psychiatrists if you, let's say, see four patients within an hour to determine what medications are appropriate rather than spending a whole hour seeing one patient?
There's a lot more money to be made. It's really all about volume. So we are paid by the insurance companies per visit. And if we can squeeze three or four patients into an hour, we can make $300 or so dollars in that hour. Whereas if we treat only one patient, we might make $100.
You have one really interesting statement in your book, a provocative statement. You say, "The shocking truth is that psychiatry has yet to develop a convincing explanation for the pathophysiology of any illness at all." You're saying we don't know what causes basically all the problems that induce people to come in to see you.
And that's quite right. And that's not even a particularly controversial thing. I don't think there's too many psychiatrists that would argue with me on that score. And what I'm really saying is that we do not understand the molecular biology or the neurobiology of what causes any of the conditions we treat. But paradoxically, we do have some medications that can be very, very effective. But again, what we miss is the fact that even though the medications can be effective, and they surely do work on the brain in some way, the psychotherapies can also be extremely effective. And in fact, they also work on the brain, as brain imaging studies have shown. So the idea that there should be a disconnect between medications on the one hand and psychotherapy on the other hand is really a fallacy.
Now, there is a more sinister aspect to this whole story as well, and that's what pharmaceutical companies do to sell their drugs, and especially to get doctors to advocate on behalf of particular medications. And you have played that game yourself. Can you tell me how you got involved in this?
I did play that game. This was back in 2002. Not that that excuses me. That wasn't that long ago. But what happened is that a rep from one of the drug companies, Wyeth, which makes an antidepressant called Effexor, or Effexor XR, asked me if I would give some talks on the part of the company to doctors as a member of their speakers bureau. And I have to say, I was quite flattered that he would have thought that I could do such a thing. And I accepted, thinking that it would be an interesting job. It would be a way to kind of get out of the office and do something different and to make some extra money. And the fact that he also invited my wife and I to New York for a couple of days with Broadway tickets and a $1,000 check thrown in didn't hurt matters. So after that, I did, I'd say over about a year in 2002, I gave about 30 talks to mainly to primary care doctors.
So these would be usually lunches, right? You would go and visit some clinic or hospital and you would say, look, here is some research showing the effectiveness of Effexor. And you were basically trying to convince the doctors on hand to think about prescribing this drug.
Exactly. We called them lunch and learns because the reps would come in with the sandwiches and then I would come in with the education. It was sort of a dog and pony show that the pharmaceutical industry is very used to doing. I would give a spiel, and the spiel would be about how to treat depression. But I realized over the course of time that the expectation is that I would embellish all of the positive qualities of the antidepressant. And I would minimize the negative qualities, you know, and all drugs are going to have blemishes. And for Effexor, one of the blemishes was that it causes hypertension in high doses. And another one is that it's very, very hard to stop. It causes very strange and bizarre withdrawal syndromes that can last for a week or more. And these are not the kinds of things that the drug reps obviously wanted me to highlight in these talks.
And you say that your conscience started getting to you when you were giving these talks. And then there was one where you pointed out the side effects, and the drug company came back and said, you know, maybe you had an off day, or maybe your heart really isn't into doing these talks anymore.
Right. And they actually said, I'll never forget the way he put it. He said, Dr. Carlyde, I heard from the other reps that you weren't quite as enthusiastic about our product at your last talk. And at that point, I realized that the way they saw me was really virtually only as a salesperson rather than as an educator of doctors. And he asked me, had I been ill, as though that would be the only conceivable reason I might not say something glowing about their product. And that was the last time I gave one of those talks.
How much were you getting paid for each of your talks?
$750 per talk. And I made about $30,000 last time I looked, about $30,000 over the course of that year.
Now, what I found especially startling about your description of all of this is that the drug companies seem to know or have found out almost precisely what kind of medications various doctors are prescribing. Somehow they know if a doctor at a particular clinic is prescribing their drug or competing drugs.
They do. It's a very sophisticated marketing tool that I was very naive when I first started this, but I found out about it over the course of my talks. But it's called prescription data mining. And as it implies, it means that the drug company is able to mine data about the doctor's prescription patterns from the drugstore. And then the drug reps in the field have that data in real time in their laptops. And so when they go into a doctor's office, someone once said that they are armed and dangerous with their laptops because they know exactly how many drugs of each category each doctor that they're going to be calling on has prescribed.
So essentially your sales pitch when you were doing this was to tout the benefits of Effexor and essentially to say it's better than some of these other medications, whether Zoloft or Prozac or what have you.
Yes, yes. And we did it in subtle ways. But what we did is we highlighted certain data that was really very preliminary at the time, showing that there was a chance that patients got a little bit better on the average when they took Effexor than when they took some of the competing antidepressants. But what was typically left unmentioned is the preliminary nature of that data. And over time, as more and more data had accrued, it turned out that if there is any efficacy separation between these two medications, it's extremely tiny and it's probably not clinically significant.
Now, what you're really talking about is a certain amount of trust that your profession has lost, specifically with this problem of selling products on behalf of drug companies, but sort of in a more general sense about whether psychiatrists are doing the best they can to help patients. And it does raise the question, what can you do to regain the trust of the public?
That is probably the major question here, because along with all the bad publicity that doctors have been getting about the drug company money, we've also been hearing a lot of bad publicity about the drugs themselves. And we've been hearing about side effects of antidepressants, such as sexual side effects, even suicidality, side effects of antipsychotics, such as obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and on and on. And it seems that with every year, we learn about more side effects. So it's kind of a perfect storm of the public seeing that the psychiatrist getting millions of dollars from the drug companies, and then they're also seeing the psychiatrist prescribing so many drugs and being really fixated on the drug solution as the only solution without regard to the fact that we really don't understand the long-term side effects of these drugs.
At the end of your book, you write about how psychiatrists need to develop a vision of what the ideal psychiatrist would be. What's your vision of that?
Basically, I think what people want is a psychiatrist that can say to them, I do not take any money from the pharmaceutical industry because I want to make my decisions based on what's best for you and not what's best for the drug company's bottom line. I know how to do psychotherapy. I know how to understand you psychologically because, after all, I am a psychiatrist. That's what psychiatrists do. And I do know how to combine the right kinds of medications with the right kind of psychotherapy. But what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to have only one tool in my arsenal, and I'm not going to always be reaching for a medication.
Daniel Carlyde is a psychiatrist and the author of Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry. a doctor's revelations about a profession in crisis. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think about Carlat's opinions on what's wrong with psychiatry? You can let us know by sending email through our website, ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to our Facebook page. Coming up, we'll find out how anxiety and sound are connected in the angst-ridden fiction of Franz Kafka as we conclude our hour on anxiety and mental illness. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Brian Kane teaches music theory at Yale. He also has a strong interest in the role that sound plays in Franz Kafka's fiction. Kane gave a presentation called Listening to the Burrow, Kafka and Acousmatic Sound, at Columbia University last year. Kane explains the meaning of acousmatic sound.
The definition of it is, strictly speaking, a sound that one hears without seeing the causes behind it. So it's really a sound that's heard in the absence of other contextual clues. So you don't see where it's coming from. You know, radio, for instance, is actually a fantastic medium that is filled with acousmatic sounds. You know, listeners don't know what I look like. They may not know what you look like. They don't know if we're in the same room or different rooms. So radio is a medium that exploits the possibilities of acousmatic sound wonderfully.
Would you tell us about the burrow, what the story's about?
Like many of Kafka's stories, plot is not always the essential feature. The burrow is essentially a story about a mole, some kind of burrowing creature that builds a kind of elaborate underground lair. And this creature is a creature that has a lot of anxiety to begin with. It's a creature that has a kind of overactive, hypothetical imagination. It thinks through all the kind of possible ways that this burrow will be absolutely secure from invaders. And after a brief sojourn above ground, this burrower comes back into his burrow and hears a sound that he can't identify where it's coming from. He describes it as a kind of high-pitched, monotonous whining or whistling noise. The German word is this word pfeifen, which I guess literally translates as a kind of piping, which is a pretty interesting word to describe this sound. So it's a high-pitched, monotonous sound. It comes on and off. It's always on the same thin note. And the burrower basically spends the second half of the tale trying to figure out where the source of this sound could be coming from.
Have I come then to a new conclusion concerning the cause of the noise? But surely the noise is caused by the channels bored by the small fry? Is not that my considered opinion? It seems to me that I have not retreated from it thus far. And if the noise is not caused directly by these channels, it is indirectly. And even if it should have no connection with them whatever, one is not at liberty to make a priori assumptions, but must wait until one finds the cause, or it reveals itself. One could play with hypotheses, of course, even at this stage. For instance, it is possible that there has been a water burst at some distance away, and what seems a piping or whistling to me is in reality a gurgling. But apart from the fact that I have no experience in that sphere, the groundwater that I found at the start I drained away at once, and in this sandy soil it has never returned. Apart from this fact, the noise is undeniably a whistling, and simply not to be translated into a gurgling. But what avail all exhortations to be calm? My imagination will not rest, and I have actually come to believe, it is useless to deny it to myself, that the whistling is made by some beast, and moreover, not by a great many small ones, but by a single big one.
There's a whole variety of possibilities, and the burrower never actually figures out what the cause of the sound is because the story breaks off at a certain point.
Of course, you begin to wonder at some point during the story whether there is a sound or not, because the anxiety level of the narrator, the burrower, is so high, you begin to wonder whether he hasn't just created this in the way that he's created other worries in his life.
Well, I think that this is part of what's interesting about acousmatic sound, at its most kind of extreme case. I mean, this Kafka story is a pretty extreme case of it. But at its highest degree of extremity, We often can't tell if the sound is something that we're subjectively producing or something that is actually being produced on the outside. We can't tell if it's our creation or the world's creation. And so this is one of the fascinating things about acousmatic sound. It verges very closely in its most extreme forms on something like an auditory hallucination. Kafka is constantly giving us clues. We don't know if they're good clues or not, but he's constantly giving us clues that perhaps the sound is a sound that's being imagined by the burrower. But the burrower himself never entertains that possibility in the story. So we don't really have enough evidence to decide if it is coming from within or without. And I think that the ambiguity is one of the characteristic features of acousmatic sound in its purest form.
In the talk that you've given about Kafka's literary treatment of acousmatic sound, you connect it to musique concrète. Do you see a commonality between the two?
Well, the term acousmatic sound is a term that emerges in the context of musique concrète. It's actually a term that gets popularized by Pierre Schaeffer, a French musician and composer and engineer who kind of invented musique concrète in the late 1940s. So he's the person who really theorizes acousmatic sound for us. It's not a term that Kafka would have used to describe his own work. It wasn't really available to him. So by talking about musique concrète and Schaeffer's work, I'm able to position Kafka within this theory of acousmatic sound. I think that it's the right way to talk about Kafka's sound, but I needed to sort of do it anachronistically in order to give it a term, so to speak.
You played an excerpt from Schaeffer's Etude au chemin de fer at your presentation. Can you tell me a little bit about that piece and how you hear it through Kafka's mind in the burrow?
Yeah. When you're dealing with musique concrète, especially in Schaeffer's, in this etude, this train study, basically, all of the sounds are coming from the same source. They're all coming from a train. This train is clanking over the tracks, the train whistle blows. There's lots of different ways of producing sounds using the train as the source, but everything is organized around the source. So all the different effects and all the different causes, they're all unified in a certain sense around the source. If you compare this to what's going on in Kafka's burrow, in Kafka you're really only given the effect of the sound. There's a kind of great indeterminacy about the source and the cause of this high-pitched whistling. The burrower experiences the effect, but because he can't put his finger on what could be causing it or where the source is, it creates this kind of great anxiety that's attached to acousmatic sound. And Kafka, in a way, is able to articulate, I think, an extraordinarily important thesis about acousmatic sound, which is that when you're given a kind of auditory effect on its own, when it's unaccompanied by vision and other contextual clues, that auditory effect, in a sense, underdetermines the attributions of source and cause. And this underdetermination, I think, is an essential part of why acousmatic sound has its kind of affective power over the subject. So I can't really explain that unless I've got musique concrète in the picture. I need to be able to compare something like musique concrète with what Kafka's doing to show it as a kind of counterexample.
There was another excerpt that you played from Parmigiani.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like the sound that is presented in the burrow, don't you think?
Well, I mean, I had used it originally as a contrast class. It's very much like Schaeffer's etude in one sense, that rather than being organized around the source of the sound, many of the sounds in the Parmigiani piece are organized around the cause. They all have a similar kind of causality. All the sounds feel like they've been shot out of a cannon or across space. They feel like missiles or arrows that are being fired, and they have Doppler effects. So there's a kind of similar causality to all the sounds. I was using that as a kind of other contrast class to Kafka, but I mean, I think there are certain aspects of the sounds themselves in Parmigiani that I guess one could imagine as being like the sounds in Kafka's burrow. But there's this incredible problem, actually, about recreating the sound of Kafka's burrow. It's not clear to me that one could ever come up with a sound that could do all of the things that Kafka's describing the sound as doing.
Is it different, do you think, than the way Kafka perceived sound, wrote about sound in others of his stories, like Josephine or Investigations of a Dog?
Kafka approaches sound in a very unusual way. Sound is always a kind of mysterious phenomenon for him. I think Kafka experienced sound and music in a way that is not the norm. Even in his diaries, for instance, he describes what he calls his unmusikalisch sein, as unmusicality as a kind of way of being in the world. I mean, he's aware of the fact that he kind of had a total inability to hear music because he always heard sound and not music. In a way, it's a kind of strange gift that Kafka has to be able to kind of alienate the typical, habitual, and conventional ways in which we understand an appropriate sound and start to appreciate sound as sound. And it always has a mysterious quality for him. So in Josephine the Mouse Singer and in Investigations of a Dog, in both cases, there's always something mysterious about the sound. In Josephine, her singing, which is actually called a piping, it's the same word, a pfeifen, that Kafka uses. The narrator's trying to find the kind of mystery of this. Why is this piping not just simply a piping, but a kind of singing? In the Investigations of a Dog, there's this interesting situation of these dogs that are dancing and music is coming off of their body, and the dog who's in the bushes watching this choreography can't figure out how these things are correlated with one another, although he knows that they are. So sound is always a kind of place that begins an investigation in Kafka.
It's fascinating to think about it, isn't it? Because if Kafka really did, as he suggests in that quotation from his diary, not hear music as music, but instead as sound, then maybe those of us who do hear music can't understand what it is he is hearing.
I mean, we often think about music as being sounds plus relationships, organized sound, right? It brings out certain features of sound. But I think that we are able to appreciate something like the sonic itself within music. It takes a little bit of kind of psychological reorientation. One has to focus in on the timbral features of sound, but I think it's possible to do. And I think Kafka gives us access to this because he seems to be especially fixated on these aspects of sound.
And the musique concrète does sort of the same thing. If you take train sounds and make them into musical notes or phrases, you're doing both sound and music at the same time.
Right. There's a kind of shared modernist project, I guess, that Kafka and musique concrète both have, which is a certain kind of alienation of sound from its previous context and reorganization. The difference, though, is I think Kafka puts his finger on the potential uncertainty and anxiety that accrues to these sounds, while the musique concrète composers are much more interested in kind of good old-fashioned aesthetic phenomena that are available within these sounds.
So for Kafka, the anxiety of sound may be its primary feature.
I think for Kafka, I think anxiety and sound are closely aligned with one another.
Brian Kane is an assistant music professor at Yale and the author of the paper Listening to the Burrow, Kafka and Acousmatic Sound. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 74B, Anxiety. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.